Welcome to Menopause Reimagined. I'm your host, Andrea Donsky, and I'm a nutritionist for more than 16 years who's in menopause. I'm a menopause educator and menopause researcher. The goal for this show is to empower you as you go through perimenopause and menopause so you can take charge of your health and your symptoms as you go through this phase of life. Today, I'm speaking with Lara Bryden. She's a naturopathic doctor and author of the books Period Repair Manual and Hormone Repair Manual, practical guides to treating period problems with nutrition and supplements. She lives in New Zealand, and she treats women with PCOS, PMS, endometriosis, perimenopause, and many other hormone and period-related health problems. Now, here's Lara. Welcome to Menopause Reimagined, Lara.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I am really excited to talk to you. I know that you are an expert at the Menopause Shift Summit, and Anne-Marie interviewed you, and I love everything that you talk about and your expertise on hormones and being a practicing naturopathic doctor. So I really wanted to dive in today to talk about hormones, to talk about estrogen, progesterone, HRT, BHRT, and kind of everything that is out of my lane, I like to say. Everything sure. That I want to learn about it so that everybody who's listening can learn about it too. So what inspired you to study hormones, to even go into this, to work with women's health?
Yeah, I think it was a couple of things. I started out in general practice as a naturopathic doctor, and you can hear from my accent, I'm Canadian like you, even though I live down under now. And yeah, I started out in general practice, but a lot of my patients were women looking for solutions for period problems. I was treating menopause way back then when I was like 27. So it was kind of fun to, know about it, 25 years before I had to go through it myself. And then, so that was part of what drove me to do a deeper dive into female physiology and learn what works for women. But part of it too, it's interesting because before I became a naturopathic doctor, I was a evolutionary biologist. I published a peer-reviewed paper in sex differences in foraging behavior in animals. And recently, actually just last summer, I went out to the Bamfield Research Station for any Canadian listeners out on Vancouver Island and looked at some of the papers I wrote when I was there doing a course out there, looking at a couple of papers I wrote, and I was super interested in female physiology back then. So it's come out of a curiosity of being a biologist, of feeling like, sex differences are not sort of acknowledged enough. And that's where it all sort of came. And then, of course, I've had 25 years of working with women and getting to find out what works for period problems and perimenopause and discovering, much to my delight, that the things I was taught as a naturopathic doctor, nutrition, herbs, diet works actually very well for these kinds of problems.
You mentioned that you were working with women when you were in your 20s who were in menopause.
Yeah.
Was there anything that you would say that surprised you or didn't surprise you actually? Because when you think about it, when you're in your 20s and you're like working with women and you can't really understand it until you're in that phase of life.
Yeah.
Was there anything that you were kind of like, when you got there, you were like, of course now I understand it, but like anything that really stood out for you?
Yeah. I think the thing that pops into my mind when you ask that question, and I'd actually like to speak a little bit more about working with women back in the 90s, but, the thing that comes to mind is that much to my sort of delight and surprise is like, oh, it's fine. I think as young women, we dread, well, at least I did, menopause, the stigma, the aging, pretty much just not wanting to accept that that's going to happen to me. And then once I got here, I'm like, oh, it's actually fine. And as I describe in my book, Hormone Repair Manual, I did just intuitively like discover this sort of sensation of second girlhood and this kind of cheeky wanting to be outdoors, just like being able to say no to things more firmly. And then I discovered that's in the research, and it's almost across cultures that a lot of women do get this sort of return to what some of the researchers describe as sort of an authentic self, our 9-year-old self, reconnecting with our 9-year-old self. So that was a nice discovery. And I think looking back, my patients had kind of talked about some of that, but you just don't know until you get here.
What advice would you give to your patients you know, who haven't reached menopause, that now that you're there, that you would say, here's the one thing that I think you should do as you get in before you get into that phase of life?
One thing, and again, the thing that comes to mind is just the piece of information that it's temporary. So as you probably know, you know, if not everyone has symptoms, but if you're going to have symptoms, especially the neurological symptoms, they're more likely to happen during those few years leading up to the final period and the 1 or 2 year after the final period. And that is second puberty. And if the neurological symptoms that may arise during that time are temporary, so of course we want to, you know, treat them and feel better. And that's, we'll talk about some of that today. But also I think even just knowing that it's not going to last forever is important. So the quote that I love is from my colleague and mentor, Professor Geraldine Pryor, who's also Canadian. She's out at UBC. She said, women need to know that the turbulent time of perimenopause ends in the kinder and calmer phase of life called menopause. Yeah. So, and that's important because a lot of women think, oh my goodness, this is how I'm always going to be now. And that is not how you're always going to be. So if you're feeling sort of destabilized and not sleeping and, you know, just more anxious about things than you used to be, that's all a common experience. And it's part of the rewiring of the brain that I talk about in my book. You wouldn't, for example, look at a 14-year-old boy and think, oh, that's how he's always going to be now. Like that, you know, these emotional changes he's going through. Like, so we intuitively know that for first puberty, but I think we don't have the same framing for second puberty. So,
well said. And it's just being gentle with ourselves and kind to ourselves as our body's recalibrating, right? So I love that. That's an amazing quote. And I love, so thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Nice. I might just say something about the 90s, because I know you want to talk a little bit about hormone therapy today and body identical versus non-body identical. So I got, because I've been doing this for 25 years, my first patients back in the, right, so the Women's Health Initiative study was 2001, right? So I was treating women before that, for 4 or 5 years before that. So they were all on Premarin. So as you probably know, the pendulum swings on hormone therapy. So the more recent memories, we've had this, you know, scare around the Women's Health Initiative study. And, you know, a lot of women were yanked off hormone therapy when they probably didn't need to be. I mean, I can definitely agree with that. But I started practicing back in the time when it was the previous era of super gung-ho hormone therapy, like very gung-ho. Like women were told, if you don't take this, you'll get a heart attack. Like, you know, you have to take this. So that was sort of, a lot of the women I was seeing back then in the mid to late 90s, they were pretty much all on Premarin. That, like, your listeners would know Premarin, right? This is the horse urine.
Why don't you just explain? Because we do have other interviews where we've talked about it, but please, for those who are new to
the
podcast, it would be great.
So these are the old school drugs. So Premarin is made from horse's urine, pregnant mare urine, hence the name. So it has a lot of different estrogens, none of which are, actually it has estrone that's pretty close to human estrogen, but like it's not the nice body identical estradiol that we have now. It's quite a mix actually of estrogens. I have my Australian accent happening here. And and then Provera was the progestin that was used. It wasn't real progesterone like is used now. So, but at that time it was very gung-ho. Everyone should be on it. My main job back then in the 90s was switching women to what we used to call bioidentical hormone therapy, because as naturopathic doctors, collectively in general, we had concerns about the safety of that type of hormone therapy that everyone was using back then. And so thought that body identical or bioidentical progesterone would be safer. And it turns out it is safer, because we're 25 years on and we have the research now to prove that. But that was ahead of the research at that time. There was only sort of, there was more just a biological plausibility, just thinking it through, right? It makes sense to take hormones that are identical to the body's own hormones. That's safer. Yeah. They had to be made at a compounding chemist. So my main job was just trying to transition women onto the safer hormone therapy. Right. And yeah, because you can't just come off it. I mean, I don't know, a lot of women did after the Women's Health Initiative, but just coming straight off like estrogen cold turkey is rough, like really, really rough, because it's estrogen's addictive. So the Women's Health Initiative study, 2002, I guess it was. It was right around the time I moved to Sydney, Australia, and set up a clinic there. Yeah. So they, as you know, it was a randomized controlled trial, trying to trial hormone therapy. And there were so many bad things. I've heard the study talked about many times, that there were some weird things about it. Like they only included women without symptoms. They had to do that because women with symptoms might not just accept being on the placebo. They use older women, so women much kind of older than would normally take hormone therapy. They did pick up this small signal of breast cancer and increased risk of breast cancer and cardiovascular disease from the hormone therapy group. And I think depending on how you look at those numbers, the safety signal was actually still relatively quite small, considering it was those old school drugs. And now, and you may have had experts who talk about the study in more detail. I mean, what some of the things that are coming out of this is, it does seem like the small breast cancer risk that was associated even with the old school style of hormone therapy was mostly from the progestin. So those, and this is a crux of the matter for hormone therapy. This has always been, from when I started practicing 25 years ago till now, body identical progesterone is safer for the breasts than progestin. So that is pretty much just a fact now. I think we all know that. I mean, Professor Pryor, who I mentioned earlier, she would take it a step further and say that body identical progesterone may even reduce the risk of breast cancer. But the official version is that it's kind of neutral, right, with regard to that risk, which kind of makes sense, because progesterone normally would slow down proliferation of tissue. It's like, it's the kind of hormone that says, whoa, you know, put the brakes, mature, and, you know, stop dividing. So that kind of makes sense that real progesterone would be helpful. Whereas, unfortunately, I think there was wishful thinking that progestins were okay, but they're not. They do have a safety risk. So do you think your listeners will understand what I mean about body identical progesterone versus progestin, or should we?
I think you should give, I mean, we've talked about it with Dr. Lakeisha. I interviewed Dr. Lakeisha McMillan. So I'll put a link to that if you wanted to, yeah, for those of you who are listening who want to know more about the Women's Health Initiative. But please, yeah, Laura, Dr. Yeah, please go into it. It's always good to have a refresher. So go for it.
Yeah. So the confusing thing about it, trying to talk about this for years, one of the things that is muddying the waters is that the word estrogen is a generic term that can refer accurately to any number of estrogens, including some of those horse estrogens, equine estrogens, or our own body's estradiol, which is our main ovarian estrogen. Is estradiol is usually the body identical estradiol is the what most women take now as a patch, for example. So estrogen is a generic term, whereas progesterone is not a generic term, actually. Unfortunately, that's where some of this confusion is happening. It's sometimes used that way. Like even for younger women, we talk about progesterone-only birth control. That is inaccurate. Those are all there's no progesterone, real progesterone, in any type of birth control. They're all progestins. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so progestins are the synthetic analogs of progesterone. Some of them are actually derived from testosterone. They're different molecules. Okay. And there's actually a whole assortment of them. And depending on which progestin, it can actually have quite different effects in the body. Like some progestins are derived from testosterone, quite androgen-like, or have testosterone-like effects. Some are anti-testosterone. They're derived from, you know, diuretic medications. So there's a whole assortment. And to just call all of those things progesterone has led to a lot of confusion, because it's actually on the progestin versus progesterone side that most of this dilemma has been. Like in truth, the sort of synthetic estrogens, like the one in the pill, most pills, is called ethanol estradiol. It's not the same, but it's somewhat similar to our own estradiol, whereas the progestins versus progesterone are really quite different. And they're different in their effect on the breasts, which I just talked about, how, you know, progesterone may even reduce the risk of breast cancer, which is very different than any progestin. Yeah. They're different. Progestin versus progesterone are different in the brain. So progesterone, real progesterone, that's the progesterone we either make by ovulating, having a natural menstrual cycle, by being pregnant, we make a huge amount of progesterone, or by taking it in the form of a body identical preparation like Prometrium in North America, Utrogestin in the UK. Those are the mainstream brand names for progesterone. There's other ones too, Teva, and like there's, you have, it's called oral micronized progesterone, is, and it's capsules. Progesterone in the brain metabolizes to a neurosteroid called allopregnanolone, which is the brain loves, basically. It's very tranquilizing. It can help to promote neurogenesis. It's quite good for the brain. Whereas no, just as an example, no progestin metabolizes to allopregnanolone. Every time I talk to a scientist who's kind of starting to study progesterone, I always ask her, like, do any progestins convert to allo? And they're like, no. So that's just an example of how different they truly are. And just on the tranquilizing side of progesterone, do take it at bedtime. So anyone who's been prescribed Prometrium or oral micronized progesterone capsule, I mean, hopefully your pharmacist would have said this, but you really do need to take it at bedtime because it can make you feel quite groggy and weird if you try to take it during the day. And most women get a nice tranquilizing, like almost like a sleeping pill effect from real progesterone capsules. Some women get, I'd say it's about 1 in 20 women get paradoxical anxiety reaction from it. We can talk about that a little bit today. It's somewhat dose dependent. So sometimes you can, you know, try a few different doses and find the one that feels better.
What dose do you recommend for taking it at night? And this is the oral.
Yeah, well, so for menopausal hormone therapy, the standard dose, just to be matched with, say, a 25 or 50 microgram estradiol patch, you could then take a 100 milligram Prometrium capsule. Depending on if you need perhaps more help for the, you know, thinning the uterine lining or more help for sleep, you could do 200 milligrams. I mean, the range is between 100 and 300 milligrams of progesterone, and that, you know, the doctor will decide what's appropriate. And then there's the whole question of, do you take it continuously or do you take it 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off? That's cyclic progesterone. There's a whole other part of this, which is that progesterone, so it can be used as the kind of progestin part of menopausal hormone therapy, the part to protect the uterus and then give you all these other benefits in terms of brain and breasts that you wouldn't get from a progestin. Progesterone can also be used on its own, which I talk about in my book, Hormone Repair Manual, which is a lot of that's coming out of Professor Geraldine Pryor's work. So progesterone, and again, body identical real progesterone, can be quite helpful for some of the perimenopausal symptoms of heavy periods and sleep disturbance and premenstrual night sweats. And Geraldine has clinically trialed it for both perimenopause and menopause and got a good result. So we could put those links to that research in the show notes if you want. But there's advantages to taking progesterone alone rather than just progesterone combined with estradiol. And really, when it really shines is when in the earlier phases of perimenopause, when women are going through quite a high estrogen phase and estrogen's going up and down quite dramatically. And progesterone is just, as I say in my book, just quietly leaving the scene. Like progesterone just quietly goes away. Like our luteal phases, that's part of our cycle when we make progesterone, gets shorter and less robust. And then we start having more cycles where we don't make any progesterone at all. That's the different words. I mean, that's the estrogen dominance, if you want to call it that. I don't actually use that terminology, but that's when you start getting in our 40s, what's called dysfunctional uterine bleeding. So that's like unopposed estrogen, basically. You're making tons or heaps of estrogen, as they say down here, and no progesterone to counteract it, because estrogen normally thickens the uterine lining, whereas progesterone thins the uterine lining. So this is where the crazy periods of our 40s comes from in part. And so progesterone can be used to lighten flow, which is, Professor Pryor has a protocol around that, how to use it cyclically for that or continuous dosing, depending on how severe the heavy periods are. And progesterone can help to prevent migraines. I always feel like I'm doing a bit of a infomercial for progesterone, but it's sort of the forgotten hormone. It's like the Cinderella hormone that you know, should have been at the ball and has not been for, you know, a few decades.
Yeah. For years, my gynecologist put me on progesterone because I had PCOS. And so I was on it for probably, oh my gosh, over 10 years, but he put me on, it was a topical progesterone.
Yeah.
Still doing a topical now. So you're talking about oral, what's the difference, and is topical the same way?
Okay. Good question. So that would have been a rather progressive integrative gynecologist to give you natural progesterone, which is great. Yeah. So there is, just on the topic of PCOS, Professor Pryor is currently, her current clinical trial that she's doing is on cyclic progesterone therapy for PCOS. So your gynecologist was correct that progesterone can help to reestablish regular ovulation and do lots of good things for PCOS, can have an anti-androgen effect. In answer to your question about cream versus capsule, well, there's a whole story to that. And I guess, I'll try to give you the broad strokes. There have been some studies that have found that progesterone works to do its job of thinning the uterine lining. So for example, as part of menopausal hormone therapy to protect the uterine lining from estrogen, that creams cannot deliver on that.
Okay.
With that regard. I mean, if you're taking it for that, or like, check with your doctor. Cause I mean, not everyone agrees with that, but the official sort of line on that is that capsules are required, even like with natural progesterone, which is what we're talking about now, capsules are required to deliver that, you know, uterine protective effect. So because of that sort of current status of the science, you do get some experts saying, oh, progesterone cream is pseudoscience and doesn't work and doesn't do anything. And that's not true either, because progesterone, I mean, obviously progesterone, like, so 30, 25 years ago, they used to say, oh, hormones can't be delivered through the skin. What are you talking about? People were using progesterone cream back then. Yeah. But yes, hormones can be delivered through the skin, hence estrogen patches and gels now. So progesterone does absorb through the skin. It doesn't actually show up very high blood serum levels, which I think is where some of the confusion has come from. But there's no question in my mind that a progesterone cream can deliver some progesterone that can be beneficial for mood and sleep and migraines and even potentially lightening periods to some extent. The one thing about oral progesterone, though, one advantage it may have for some people is that with oral, you get more of the conversion to allopregnanolone, which is the neurosteroid that I talked about earlier. In fact, I might have said the neurosteroid. The neurosteroid actually forms in the liver, so most of it. It forms in all tissues. But with oral ingestion of progesterone, then you do get this through the liver, and you get more allopregnanolone being formed, which is more sedating. So oral progesterone is generally more sedating or tranquilizing. So if people are using it for sleep, then it sometimes can be worth taking oral. If people are using it for migraine prevention, oral can be better. Yeah. So I don't know if that gives you the lay of the land with progesterone cream, but actually, weirdly, progesterone cream has been controversial. Like, it has been sort of a target of derision and sort of like, you know, saying that that's not a thing. So if anyone's listening has maybe heard some, you know, question marks around progesterone cream, I hope that's explained things a bit better. I would say it is still a valid treatment, and lots of doctors have used it. Yeah.
It's interesting because I'm currently, so for the longest time, I didn't take body identical hormone or BHRT, you know, or bioidentical hormone. There's so many terms for it. And I know body identical is more a newer term. And I wanted to try it recently within the last year. And I was able to manage all of my symptoms through lifestyle, nutrition, and supplements, which is what I talk about all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
But having listened to, you know, doctors like yourself and, you know, some other experts that I've interviewed and listened to on a regular basis, I was like, you know what? I really want to try it. Like, I think it's something that we're looking now at Dr. Lisa Moscone's research on the brain. And we're looking at research done, you know, on for heart disease and osteoporosis. So I just wanted to try it for myself so that I can also talk about it with knowledge. And what I noticed when I started taking it, and I'm doing the body identical, I am doing topical. And this is why what you're saying is very interesting to me. And now it's making me think maybe I should switch to oral progesterone. And I'm taking a very small dosage, like 0.25 milligrams, like really, really small dosage. But in the beginning, it actually, I had managed my hot flashes, but it was giving me hot flashes. It started giving me some symptoms that I had already completely got rid of. And so I tried it for a couple of months and then I went off and I'm like, this is giving me hot flashes and night sweats. Like, yeah. I'm doing this. And then I was like, okay, let me try it again. And now I up my dosage of the progesterone and it seems to be helping. Like that seemed to be the trick, but I'm thinking maybe I'll switch to an oral just because, you know, from what you're saying, I mean, I like to experiment and try, but
sure.
Me from what you're saying about taking hormone therapy is that perhaps if you're taking the estrogen, perhaps the oral progesterone could be a better way to go. And I'm just curious. That's why it's great. Interesting to hear you say it. And that's why to learn.
Well, the standard recommendation is transdermal estradiol and oral body identical oral micronized progesterone. Like I said, some doctors are going outside of that and just using transdermal progesterone for you to protect the uterine lining. I mean, I'm not going to say that's wrong. I suspect it could still work. I mean, if anyone is doing that, they can sort of just, the doctor will check in and do an ultrasound of the uterine lining and make sure that it's protecting the way it should be. So, and yeah, like I said, you can, there might be this beneficial tranquilizing effect, but I'll just say, I totally respect you're just trying it out because you're obviously talking about hormone therapy with a lot of experts and with your followers and you want to be able to speak to it. And I think that's totally valid. I mentioned the pendulum earlier, how 25 years ago, there was this super, every woman should be on hormone therapy. If you don't, you're crazy because you're going to get you're going to get die early kind of thing. That was, and then it swung all the way around. It was like, no one should take it because it's too scary. Yeah. And now, depending who you talk to, it's swung too far back that way. It's and I mean, I will just,
that. I think it, making you feel guilty if you're, you know,
yeah. So let's just maybe just talk about that for a few minutes because, and I think women can, they don't have to be scared of hormone therapy. Definitely if they have symptoms that require it, then obviously in consultation with their doctor, you know, try some body identical hormone therapy. I think that's a totally reasonable thing to do and not a risky thing to do at all. And it is true that there's this interesting research around brain and cardiovascular system. I have a chapter about, I quote Lisa Moscone quite a bit in Hormone Repair Manual, so I have a whole brain chapter. So I guess the way I want to try to explain it is, there is this, again, sort of signal from the research that for some women, the brain rewiring of adjusting to lower estrogen can create a long-term dementia risk in some people. I think that's, she's probably, Lisa, I think Moscone's right about that. And Roberta Brinton is the other researcher in this. So they've measured this drop in brain energy from a drop in estrogen. But I just want to, because you're a nutritionist, so this is perfect kind of, I mean, you may probably already know this, but this is a recalibration. So estrogen sensitizes cells, mitochondria to insulin. Like basically estrogen makes it a lot easier to get energy out of glucose. And when we have to adjust to this lower estrogen. And we'll circle back to this next statement, which is that actually our ancestors did that. Menopause is not new. You know, they were good at that. And their adjustment to we talk about how, you know, I think menopause evolved. And so there should be nothing inherently sort of bad or dangerous about this shift in insulin sensitivity, because all the brain cells have to do, and Moscone and Brinton talk about this in their research, they have to metabolically adapt. They have to become more metabolically flexible. They have to get better at sometimes using ketones for energy, not exclusively, but like being able to like just be a little bit more flexible in where they get their energy. And so what they found is this like drop in brain energy that's measurable. It's temporary. In most women who are metabolically healthy, they get through their brain cells are like, right, okay, yeah, recalibrate, we're doing this a little bit differently. We've got different substrate we've got to use for energy, and we're going to come out the other side and be healthy. So the kind of drop in cognition, which is a little scary, that can happen with adjusting to lower estrogen is temporary. So most women are going to come through that healthy. I think the women, there's probably different risk factors, but I think if you don't come through that healthily and the brain goes down the track to longer term risk. I think that's going to be when there is metabolic dysfunction or insulin resistance. And from an ancestral perspective, because I'm an evolutionary biologist, so I see everything through that lens. If you think about it, like our ancestors, they were living in a very different food environment, right? Very different. They were not at risk of insulin resistance. Like they were not dealing with, you know, high calorie foods or the opposite, actually. Like they, in some ways, in that way, you know, the shift to being more metabolically flexible, being able to get by on sort of ketones, almost would have been a superpower for those women. Because they were the grandmothers, right? So they were gathering lots of food. They didn't need as much food themselves anymore, especially the starchy foods. Probably they were like, oh, I can just get by on the leaner, like, you know, meats and berries. I mean, I'm just sort of painting a picture. And, you know, give all these high starchy foods tubers to the reproducing women, the young women and the children, and like who really needs it. So the shift in metabolism would have been fine. And so just, I hope that's not too kind of complicated. I guess what I'm saying is I think if women are metabolically healthy, and I'm sure you are, like you'd be an example of someone who, you know, is your brain's probably like, no problem. Like I've got lower estrogen, but it's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had a little maybe wobble sort of adjusting to that, but now I'm out the other side and I'm good. Like I would be very surprised if, I'm just speculating, but like someone like you would need estrogen for dementia prevention, for example. And I wish in the research, what they really need to do is separate out, like when they're looking at, does estrogen therapy, you know, reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease and dementia, I would really like to see them separate out people who have insulin resistance or prediabetes or sort of metabolic dysfunction from women who don't. Because I think if the estrogen's helping, it's mitigating the metabolic shift. I think women, yeah, it's going to help the women who have other problems. Yeah.
The issue is that so many of us are more prone to insulin resistance as we go into this phase of life, right? And there's a large percentage of people who have it. So I think that, and even if you have some type of autoimmune issue, like this year I had an autoimmune issue, and I always say I'm an N of one. I'm always tracking things in terms of understanding blood sugar. And I normally wear a CGM and I have been for the last year, just so I can understand it. And I saw that. And this is why I love what I do, because when I learn, I share. And I got diagnosed with Hashimoto's this year, and I saw how that happened. The reason what led me to even realize something was going on was because my blood sugar was changing.
Interesting.
I saw it first in my blood sugar numbers. I was like, what is going on? Because I was normally in that 70 to 90 wake up fasting glucose range. And all of a sudden I was at like 110. And these are Canadian numbers. Yeah. And I was like, whoa. So then I was like, okay, got to go to the doctor, get things tested. And that's what kind of led me onto it. And it took a long time for even to come back into the normal range, even through my regular diet. So like things start to shift. So to your point though, and I think from, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what you're saying is that we really want to be mindful. Like you're saying, we should just go in there with open eyes. It's not a panacea for everybody. It's a personal decision. You know, what it is, or speak to your doctor. Like, is that what you're trying to say at the end of the day? Like, it's more like, look at all your options.
Well, of course it is. It's always a personal decision. It's more just reassurance that, I guess, for people who maybe just for whatever reason don't want to take estrogen therapy, would rather not. Yeah. If they intuitively just feel like they don't need it, you know, and I'm just pointing out like improving insulin sensitivity and whatever you need to do to, you know, improve your metabolic health. Exactly. Like there could be other factors like thyroid. That's very interesting. Well, I might say something about that. Yeah. And then, trust that there's lots of ways to improve metabolic health and reduce long-term risk of cardiovascular disease and dementia. And some, you know, estrogen therapy can be part of that, but it's not the only tool we have. So I mean, I think, and science is still going to tell us. I mean, maybe it is important. I mean, even if menopause evolved and is not an accident of living too long, which is, I think, another important point, it's something we were meant to do. Okay. It might just be a fact that most women, you know, would live longer and do better with some amount of estrogen therapy. That's possible. The science may still show that, but that's not where the science is at currently. And one thing worth pointing out, women outlive men, even without hormone therapy. So I mean, just on a population level, women live longer unassisted. So, I mean, it's totally possible to live a long life without hormone therapy.
I think the message that really upsets me is that, and the message that you see now on social media and, you know, that's coming out is if you don't take menopause hormone therapy, you're going to die earlier. And these
are, that's wrong.
This isn't me making this up, by the way. These are what you, what we hear.
I know.
I was like, whoa, wait a second. There are a lot of women, like I have a TikTok page and there are a lot of women that saying they can't take it or they don't want to take it.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, that is so
that assertion that you need it to live long is not supported by the evidence. I mean, it's all about risks, right? Like, so yes, I mean, if you, there's a cardiovascular, it can ameliorate, estrogen therapy can arguably reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, but that's going to be in people who have existing other risks, like we just talked about, like sort of metabolic dysfunction. So it there's just a lot more to the story, I think. And
But thank you for speaking candidly about it because it is true. And I think there's so much confusion around it. And, you know, I want to go back for a second because and you were saying so many things and I was, oh, I have so many questions I want to ask you.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's go back to explaining just that you were talking about the follicular stage and you were talking about different things.
Yeah.
So let's talk about our cycle. What happens? Sure. What is our cycle like before we go into perimenopause? And then what is it like when we're in perimenopause? So you just really quickly kind of like to give us that, paint that picture for us so that, because even myself, as knowledgeable as I am, I really didn't know much about hormones and about my cycle until I started studying it. So if you could share.
For sure. Yeah, let's do that. Yeah. So we can do that quite simply, I think. And I'll just clarify to everyone listening, we're talking about natural menstrual cycles, so not pill bleeds. So pill withdrawal bleeds are not real periods. So that's not at all what we're talking about now. And also we're not, and the bleeds you get on a progestin only method are generally not real periods either, except with the hormonal IUD, you can have real cycles. So that kind of makes it more complicated. But so when we're in our peak years, you know, late 20s, early 30s, mid 30s, we make estradiol. The ovaries make it on the eggs that are being stimulated, make a lot of estradiol on the way to ovulation, getting ready for ovulation, stimulating ovulation. Then ovulation is the main event, the release of an egg, but then that forms a temporary gland that makes progesterone for 2 weeks. And it makes a lot of progesterone. We actually make 100 times more progesterone than estrogen, which is interesting in absolute terms. And so in a healthy cycle in a younger woman, the luteal phase will be 2 weeks long and there'll be quite a good level of progesterone throughout that whole time. And then if you get pregnant, obviously then it rescues the progesterone making gland, the corpus luteum, and then you make tons of progesterone and then the placenta makes progesterone and you sort of go from there during pregnancy. But if you're not pregnant, then that temporary gland ends and the drop in progesterone is pretty much what brings on the bleed in an ovulatory menstrual cycle. So that's a healthy menstrual cycle. Now, what starts to happen in our late 30s to early 40s to mid 40s, depending on genetics, it's a lot of the timing of perimenopause and menopause is really genetic. There are some other factors, but don't be too dismayed if you're going through achieving your final period on the younger end of normal. It doesn't necessarily mean you've done anything wrong. It's just your blueprint. So the normal age for the final period is anywhere between 45 to 55. There could be some outliers into their late 50s. But your period stopping because of menopause younger than 45 or certainly younger than 40 is a whole different conversation. That's early menopause. That's a different thing. But we're talking about women who are where the timing is normal, natural. In those early phases of change, you're probably still having quite regular bleeds. So this is where, what I said right at the beginning, the thing I want people to know is that if you're going to have symptoms, they're usually why you're still cycling somewhat regularly. And so this is where a lot of the confusion is coming because women will go to their doctors saying, I think I'm having perimenopausal night sweats and increased migraines probably from perimenopause. And then a doctor might say, oh no, that you're still having periods. So that, you know, come back when your periods stop. It's like, actually by the time your periods stop, you're through the worst of it. Probably you're like out the other side. So What starts to happen typically is the cycle will start to shorten, as in, by I don't mean the bleed shortens, the bleed actually can lengthen, but the counting from day one to day one of the bleed to day one of the next bleed shortens. And that's a shortening of both the follicular phase, the pre-ovulatory phase, and probably the luteal phase as well. So a healthy luteal phase should be at least 11 days. You need that to hold a pregnancy. Maximum 15 or 16 days normally is the longest luteal phase can last. And then, but in perimenopause, we start to get like 9-day luteal phase. So short luteal phases, yeah. Not as much progesterone, and then more and more cycles where we don't ovulate at all. So there's no luteal phase, but you still get a bleed. Those are called anovulatory cycles. They can happen at any age. Anovulatory cycles are also a feature of PCOS. PCOS and menopause, kind of perimenopause, kind of have some similarities actually, which is interesting. Although women with PCOS typically have a later menopause, so that's a good thing.
I was a little bit on the earlier side. I mean, I guess I don't even know. I was 49 or 50, but that's a whole other conversation because I didn't even know if I was having a cycle, but we'll park that for a second.
Okay.
But okay. Continue.
Yeah. Yeah. So then with the loss of progesterone, just quietly leaving the scene, as I said, the outcomes of that can be this anxiety. Like, so progesterone is normally quite a calming hormone. So you can start to sort of feel just destabilized nervous system. I mean, one of my main symptoms is funny in retrospect. And I talked to other friends who had it. I just kind of lost my nerve for driving, which like I used to be like a totally fearless driver, like not daunted by any kind of traffic situation or anything, icy roads in Canada. And then I just kind of started thinking, I'm going to plot a different route where I can avoid that particular, you know, maneuver. And so unfortunately,
a lot of women say they're afraid to go. Even my business partner, she won't even go the highway anymore.
Yeah, things like this. So my experience is, since I've graduated to menopause or achieved menopause, my last period was a year and three quarters ago. I feel like I'm regaining some of that. So I kind of expected to, and maybe that's why I'm feeling like, yeah, it's fine. I'm back a little bit back in the groove with things like that. But yeah, so the losing progesterone can affect the stress response system, make us less able to cope with stress, because progesterone, allopregnanolone, the progesterone's neurosteroid, actually helps to regulate the adrenal axis system. And then, of course, obviously, losing progesterone can make periods heavier. Not everyone goes that route, but about 1 in 3 women who get the crazy heavy periods of perimenopause, they're really bad. Like, so the normal acceptable upper limit for menstrual fluid that you should lose over all the days of the cycle is about 80 milliliters, so about 5 tablespoons. Women sometimes in perimenopause can lose up to 500. Oh, so like it's crazy. Like, then these poor women are like, they're like, they may have done natural all their lives. It's like never taken the pill, never always fine. And then they're like, oh my goodness, I have to have the hormonal IUD. Like, I cannot live like this. And those would have been the women that back when I started practicing, the thing I didn't say about all my patients back in the 90s, most of them had their uterus taken out. Not most, but like a good portion of them had, because that's what they used to do for these crazy heavy periods. But now, I mean, actually in some ways I think the hormonal IUD has many benefits and advantages. It certainly means some women can keep their uteruses. Mm-hmm. And for what it's worth, just on the topic of the hormonal IUD, it's not progesterone. It's levonorgestrel. It's a progestin. But you can, for everyone listening, you can actually have a hormonal IUD and take oral micronized progesterone for sleep and migraines. Like, it's not an either or situation. You can do both. Mm. Which can be quite a nice combination sometimes. And also, or micronized progesterone on its own can sometimes, well, it does lighten periods, but whether that's going to be enough, like depending on how severe the periods are, that can, and you take a lot of capsules to try to slow the periods down.
What else can they do if they have that heavy bleeding?
Yeah, well, so there's a medication called tranexamic acid. It's just a clotting agent. And I had always been kind of neutral about it. Like, you know, I guess I've had some other natural strategies I'll talk about in a minute. But I recently, some gynecologist colleagues of mine down here in Australia were just saying how good it is and how safe it is. I'm just, again, this is an example of me, I think, like, sounds like what you do, like adjusting my thinking and learning new information. I'm like, actually, that's You know, I think that's fine. I think that's, if that's, because that can help. That's a medication you take only during the flow, so not throughout the month or anything like that. And then, of course, so other ways to lighten periods is progesterone, which I've talked about. I do find that a dairy-free diet can be helpful. Now, with heavy periods, and you'll be interested from a nutrition perspective, there's a quite a strong mast cell histamine aspect to heavy periods. So have you had mast cell, have you had histamine conversations with experts before?
I haven't had this conversation yet.
Oh, right. Okay. So this is a whole niche part of natural medicine at the moment, is just understanding what kind of mast cell activation. So this is a part of the immune system that makes histamine. So it's involved in allergies, but histamine is also a stimulating neurotransmitter. And the same cells, the same part of the immune cells, mast cells that make histamine, also make heparin. So there's a lot of mast cells in the uterine lining, and heparin is a blood thinner. So there is this suggestion that this mast cell activation is part of crazy heavy periods sometimes. And the perimenopause link is that during perimenopause, early, especially in the early phases, our estrogen is spiking up to 3 times higher than it ever was before. So that's it's a roller coaster. It's going up and down and up and down. And when it's spiking high like that, that is not good for you. And estrogen stimulates mast cells. So part of the kind of estrogen-y reaction, or people sort of refer to sometimes as estrogen dominance. Again, I don't use the phrase estrogen dominance. I think it's not very accurate, but not very precise. But this sort of, people can tell when their estrogen's really high. Often they'll feel like headachy and maybe a nasal congestion and fluid. And some of that is an immune, I'll say, reaction or sort of response, this mast cell activation from estrogen. And that's also happening in the uterine lining. And that's part of, I think, what's causing heavy periods. So there's some very interesting researchers, doctors doing things like using antihistamines to lighten periods, antihistamines to help with premenstrual mood. There's even one study where they used a antihistamine like pessary, like vaginal pessary, to try to slow down heavy periods and pain. And I just thought that was, yeah, very interesting. So that's the dairy-free link. So avoiding normal, what's called A1 cow's dairy. So with A1 casein, the normal cow's dairy can, in some people, calm that sort of histamine reaction. Some people are getting a histamine reaction to that particular casein, cow's protein. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on an ablation?
Yes, right. Good question. Right. So other treatments for heavy periods. I think it's should be on the table. It's a reasonable thing to consider. I mean, it's not without risk. Any kind of procedure like that is going to have risk. And there's, you know, some concerns that you can get pain complications, and maybe, you know, the procedure, eventually the heavy periods start up again a few years down the track. But all that said, some of my patients have had it and loved it. So yeah, this is a procedure where they cauterize basically the uterine lining.
I have one more question for you, and yeah, something, you know, it's kind of a theme for throughout everything we've talked about today. Why do you think the conventional world poo-poos body identical or bioidentical hormones? Because we hear, you know, it's something that I believe in. It's something obviously you believe in. And so many of the experts that I talk to believe in, but then you hear, don't try it. It doesn't work. There's no science behind it. Why is that?
Conventional menopausal hormone therapy in 2022, almost everywhere, is body identical. So what's happened is the mainstream conventional prescriptions are now body identical or bioidentical. And that, I mean, it's not always the case. Like obviously some formulations are not body identical. So I have a blog post where I list the brand names and you can compare, like you read the label and find out if what you're taking is body identical, but chances are it is. So the standard prescription, I'm just going to say a couple brand names that, so an estrogen patch like Estradot, or that's body identical. Estradiol, Prometrium is body identical or bioidentical, progesterone. So where the, what the poo-pooing is about, I have a podcast about this, right? Sort of. So 25 years ago, when I was prescribing bioidentical hormones, there was no other way to get them than from a compounding pharmacist. They didn't exist in the mainstream yet. And back then, yeah, there was a lot of poo-pooing, kind of saying, oh no, it makes no difference. Progestin, progesterone, there's no difference. They're fine. They're the same. that was definitely a lot of poo-pooing going on about that. But then the science has caught up, and now it's pretty clear that real progesterone, progesterone that's identical to our body's own progesterone, is safer. And that is known. That's a thing. And so that's why mainstream, that's what they're prescribing, which is, thank goodness, like, we've arrived. It took longer than I predicted, took 25 years, but we're finally here, depending on your country, like, and when those formulations begin. Permetrium became available in Australia, for example, in 2016. So it's been 6 years since bioidentical became mainstream. So there is still this residual. So when some experts, when they say, oh, bioidentical, don't use that, what they're talking about is actually compounded hormone formulas. So they're using the word bioidentical, but really they mean compounded, so-called, you know, individualized. They don't like it because their view, and that's not without merit, is that it's better to use like a properly, like, one of the approved products that has like a stable, you know, a known amount of hormone in it. And that's sort of their viewpoint, but they're still using the old. So by what they didn't. Yeah. So a few parts to the history, mainstream used to not believe that body identical was safer. Now they know it is, but they still don't like the idea of women using compounded hormones, but they're still calling those bioidentical, I guess, sometimes, but actually. And the whole reason for the rebranding of body identical versus bioidentical was really to try to distance from. So the doctors who were prescribing bioidentical or body identical hormones 30 years ago were right. They were safer. But no one's going to say, oh, you were right about that. Let's now all embrace bioidentical. They've sort of just rebranded and also, I mean, a lot of doctors, probably your standard doctor, may not even kind of realize that whole backstory. They just know that Permetrium is safer. Mm. They don't kind of think about it that it's bioidentical, but that's why it's safer.
I asked my gynecologist, I said, I want to do bioidentical. And she's like, oh, I don't do that. But, you know, but I guess
she totally does.
I guess she didn't realize, yeah. Which is interesting. So,
yeah, they don't, I guess, and they're smart people. I don't know. I guess they don't really understand what that word means, but oral micronized progesterone, its whole thing is that it's body identical. It's real progesterone. Right. I don't know. It's probably just time for us all to move on from I just embrace the word body identical. If the experts, the mainstream experts, want to call it body identical, I'm happy to just use the new word. Like, I don't need to, you know, from them to say, oh, you were right about bioidentical. That's never going to happen. They're never going to say that, but that's okay. We could just move on. Everyone can agree that it's safer to use oral micronized progesterone. Awesome. In general.
What are your thoughts on testosterone?
Good question. So this is where some of the sex differences come in. So I think I have to say this. So as women, we need a little bit of testosterone, of course. It's good for building muscle and bone and libido. But we need to be a little bit careful because in women, in the female body, testosterone can cause insulin resistance and promote weight gain around the middle, as it does in PCOS. So whereas in men, it's the opposite, actually. Higher levels of testosterone will improve insulin sensitivity. So that's just sort of a fine detail, because I hear so many so-called, if they're a male hormone expert and they're talking about testosterone, I know for certain they're not going to know this detail about how testosterone can actually cause weight gain in women. So from a weight perspective, estradiol and progesterone are both generally quite good for metabolism and weight loss. Yeah. And testosterone above a certain threshold, it can cause weight gain and increase the risk of heart disease. So which is not to say to never take it. Like, testosterone can be beneficial for libido, for example, but it really needs to be a small amount and always in combination with estradiol and progesterone.
So interesting and eye-opening. And I really appreciate you doing this. So tell everyone the name of your book again and then the website, so everyone where they can find you and if they want to learn more. And you sound like your website is amazing with so much information. Please share.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Andrea. It was lovely to chat with you. Yeah. So my book is Hormone Repair Manual, Every Woman's Guide to Healthy Hormones Over 40, referencing the fact that perimenopause starts a lot younger than we think. And then my everything is larabryden.com, and all my social media is at larabryden. So I'm actually very easy to find. I've got a forum. I've got a newsletter if people want to sign up for that. So yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And for everything that you do.
Thank you. It was great to meet you.
That was awesome. I love talking to Dr. Laura Bryden. If you enjoyed my conversation, then please share this video because the more you share shows you care. And please subscribe to our podcast if you haven't done so already and share it. And please leave a testimonial because that will tell us what you think about our conversations. Thanks for watching, everyone. And remember, you got this. See you next time.